Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The Department of the Interior's National Park System includes more than 390 sites, from national parks to battlefields and even the White House. President Obama recently said it was this department, under Teddy Roosevelt, that helped lead an unprecedented effort to protect our natural resources. Joining me in the studio to discuss the environmental legacy of Teddy Roosevelt from the beginning of the 20th century and the challenges the Interior Department faces in the 21st is Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Susan. It's an honor to be here with you today.
And with us also historian Douglas Brinkley. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Susan.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, Secretary Salazar, Douglas Brinkley has written a new book that talks about Teddy Roosevelt's vision in preserving the nation's wilderness treasures. Tell us what role you think these places play in America today.
They play a very major role in terms of the economy and jobs for America. They also play a very major role in the health of our communities. And they are, at the end of the day, I think, what connects up the people of this country to our lands, our soils, our air, our wildlife. They're very special places, and I think they were all created at times when the country was in crisis. It was during the Civil War that Abraham Lincoln set aside Yosemite. It was in the time of Teddy Roosevelt where our National Wildlife Refuge System was created, the major beginnings of our National Park System, and so many other protections that went with our public lands. And then Franklin Roosevelt, in the midst of the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, also moved forward with some major investments in our public lands, the Civilian Conservation Corps and monuments and other initiatives. And now, here at the beginning of this century, we're looking at some new realities and some different challenges in energy and climate change. But it has to be one of the signature issues of our time that we look at a Great Outdoors America initiative that brings in the kind of conservation ethic that will equal what President Roosevelt did, if we possibly can imagine that.
Douglas Brinkley, your new book is called The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. A lot of credit goes to Teddy Roosevelt for his role in preserving American lands. Do you think the system we have today, what would he think of this? Was this his vision of how it would be a century after he put these lands aside?
Well, he'd be very proud of what we've done. As Secretary Salazar said, people like Franklin Roosevelt and Harold Ickes, or later Lyndon Johnson and Stuart Udall, down to Jimmy Carter in Alaska. We've had a lot of great conservation moments, meaning times when we want to save the public lands because they're beautiful and because it'll bring tourists there, and also lands for wildlife. One of the things I write about in my book is how TR essentially created U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Now, everybody knows the big national parks, the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone and Yosemite, but U.S. Fish and Wildlife operates over 500 reserves, and TR had this idea that animals deserve their own land. Now, this seemed bizarre to people 100 years ago, but it all began at Pelican Island, Florida, which was his first federal bird reservation, and he ended up creating 51 total, of places for birds. He studied the migratory routes, so all over the country. Today, when you see this that designation, NWR, National Wildlife Refuge, that's part of Theodore Roosevelt's great legacy. And he also created game reserves. I've been to the Wichita Mountains in Oklahoma, where he worked very hard to repopulate the plains with buffalo. When you go up to Montana, you could find the elk that Roosevelt tried to get reintroduced there. I could go on and on. He was a Darwinian naturalist who believed that wildlife mattered because as a boy, he climbed the Matterhorn in Switzerland, got to the top, and saw no wildlife. And he thought what was unique about America, what defined the American character, was our wilderness experience. And that included humans interacting with all sorts of wildlife. And he became an ornithologist and really a animal specialist, particularly about our creatures here in our 50 states.
You know, one of the pictures in your book is a picture of a bird that Theodore Roosevelt drew when he was a boy. And apparently he was a bird watcher even from those early days. You know, Secretary Salazar, the national parks get an enormous amount of use. They get more people visit the national parks than Major League Baseball, the National Football League, the National Basketball Association, and NASCAR combined. So lots of use, but less use now than they used to get, less use than they got, fewer visitors than a decade ago. Why do you think that's happened?
You know, I think the nation and the nation's population is suffering from nature deficit disorder, and that is that we have fewer and fewer people getting out into the outdoors, even though last year, as you say, Susan, we had over 400 million visitors to our national park system. So it continues to be a great place of visitation. But today, on average, young people are spending four minutes a day in the outdoors, and it is said 6 hours a day in front of a television or a computer. So one of our challenges of these times is really to reverse that and to get young people, all people, out into the outdoors. It's part of a healthy Americans agenda. I must say also that besides the national parks, I'm very proud of them. But to Doug's point on the wildlife refuges, we have 550 wildlife refuges in the United States, in every one of the 50 states, 150 million acres. And they are some of the places of greatest wonder. And so one of our challenges also is to let people of this country and visitors that come here from around the world know about the great beauty of these places that we have where we preserve wildlife. And it really truly is a legacy of TR.
You know, it's a stunning statistic that kids today spend 4 minutes a day in the outdoors. What can be done to get kids more interested in the outdoors, in the national parks, and in other ways of kind of interacting with nature? Does there need to be a campaign that someone leads?
I think so. I think what we need to do is to put our shoulder behind the wheel and getting kids connected up to the landscapes of America. Just this last week, I was with a number of young people from Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. out at Great Falls. You know, it changes their life just to spend a summer working with us and being a part of nature. When I was in Maine at Acadia on Saturday there also is a school called the Skudik School, which is going to have thousands of young people actually going and spending some time in the beautiful National Park of Acadia and in the wildlife areas around there. So I think we just need to do it across the nation as a crusade for our young people and for Americans to get healthy and get into the outdoors.
That's sort of a Michelle Obama theme since she took over. Is this something Michelle Obama could take on, do you think?
You know, she has been very involved in the United We Serve campaign and has been very involved with us in pushing this agenda forward. You know, we are at the national level dealing a lot with healthcare and energy and climate change and other issues, but this is certainly something which the president and Michelle are very much promoting, and so I believe we're going to see it become a reality.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. Well, at the end of your book, Douglas Brinkley, you talk about your efforts to get your own kids involved in the outdoors and acquainted with the outdoors. What do you do?
Well, I live in Austin, and it's people don't realize how much beautiful land is around Austin, and we go to places like Big Bend National Park, which is a bit of a drive, also the Guadalupe Mountains National Park, and we have wildlife refuges around us. If you look at a map on Texas, you'll see this extraordinary bird migration area around South Padre Island. You can go and actually take bird watching trips there. But more immediately, I live in a mesquite grove. We have deer in our property. We just had a kit of raccoon that were born in under our house. We have a dog and two cats.
That
and
could be a mixed blessing, the raccoons.
It was a mixed blessing. It was a mixed blessing. It was fascinating. But we're in the woods, and there's a place called the Great Basin, the Wild Basin, and we go hike there. There's a waterfall. I agree with Secretary Salazar's point of a nature deficiency disorder, and it's starting to be recognized in schools of America. I've had teachers writing me saying we're going to do more outdoor studies, that young people no longer know the difference between an oak or a maple. We've lost their sense of establishing a difference between birds or just getting that fresh air for your health and clearing your mind. That's how TR saw it. He saw he loved the American West, and he liked what's today's medium-sized cities like Austin or Boulder or Eugene, Sacramento, urban centers where you're within a day's reach of just of wilderness areas, and that just a weekend in the woods or on a lake or canoeing or by a stream could replenish the spirit and get you back to your work grind. But to just just tune out our natural surroundings, Roosevelt thought was not just a mistake, but almost unpatriotic.
You know, Secretary Salazar, I know that some of the stimulus money is being directed to the national parks, about $750 million worth. What are you doing with the stimulus funds?
You know, we are investing those monies, first of all, to create jobs now and over the next 18 months, and secondly, to make sure that the projects that we're investing in are going to be the kinds of legacies that we had during the Civilian Conservation Corps. They'll continue to give back for decades and generations to come. We have about $3 billion we're investing across the department in those kinds of programs, and they'll include things such as the restoration of trails, putting in energy efficiency facilities, photovoltaic kinds of cells in our wildlife refuge facilities and national parks. So it's a shot in the arm. We have a backlog just in national parks alone of $9 billion in deferred maintenance. So $1 billion is only 1/9 of what it would take to take our national parks to the point where we'd want them to be. And so this is just a beginning effort, but obviously a very important effort for us all around the country.
We're talking to Ken Salazar, the Secretary of the Interior. He's a former Democratic U.S. Senator from Colorado. And Douglas Brinkley, who's the author of a new book called The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt and the Crusade for America. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the challenges and problems the national parks face these days. And we'll take your calls and we'll read your questions. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking this hour with the Interior Secretary, Ken Salazar, and with historian Douglas Brinkley about our national parks. We're going to go to the phones in just a moment. We were talking before the break about, Secretary Salazar, the $9 billion backlog in maintenance at national parks. And, you know, you see that even down at the National Mall here in Washington, where there are sidewalks in need of repair and problems with fetid water. Are you concerned about some of these deferred maintenance needs and what they're meaning for the national parks?
I am concerned, and we are trying to work on a program that will address those needs, not only national parks, but throughout the landscapes of America. We have made a down payment on some of that with $3 billion from the American Recovery Act, which is going to create 100,000 jobs and will help us create jobs and projects that are going to be sustainable over time. The President, President Obama, has also pushed hard for the funding of the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And so for the first time, we are on the way to fully funding the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which has really been a broken promise of the United States to the American people, I think, over the last 40 years since it was created. So we are on the way. We know that we have a long way to go. But at the end of the day, the justification for the investment in protecting our parks and our wild lands and our great landscapes of national significance are, one, they're intimately tied to the economic vitality of the nation and job creation for our country. Two, it's important for the health of Americans. And three, it is just part of the legacy of this country. When you think about the great natural and historical heritage of this country, you can see America's story and America's future through all of the work of our great outdoors. And that's why this book that Doug Brinkley has written on the Wilderness Warrior and TR is such an important contribution to the nation's understanding about the importance of these places.
Doug Brinkley, just one more question on Teddy Roosevelt before we go to the phones. You know, we see with the debates in Washington these days on health care and climate change and everything else, how hard it is to get things done. How did Teddy Roosevelt go about setting aside this enormous amount of land to save 234 million acres of American wilderness? How did he do it?
Well, look, first off, it was a different era back then, and so, but there's no question that he was a vigorous believer in executive power, and the West was largely undeveloped. So, for example, a lot of his lands that he saved, including the Grand Canyon and Petrified Forest, you know, El Morro, Chaco Canyon, I could rattle them on more and more. These were in territories at the time. This was the New Mexico Territory and Arizona Territory. It was easier to do. Wichita Mountains, the big first game reserve, was then in the Indian Territory, and they were pushing for Oklahoma statehood. And so TR did recognize Oklahoma statehood, but he could play with those territories. Also Hawaii, Alaska, and Puerto Rico, where he did good things. But Roosevelt saved about 150 million acres for national forest. He then saved millions for national monuments. He created the National Monuments, the Antiquities Act. That gave him an ISO declarate iron fist. His first one was Devil's Tower, Wyoming. And he simply would see these. He used elastic language that gave him a right to grab lands for scientific or scenic purposes. Now, the Congress thought this was for little small patches of land, you know, maybe, you know, 1,000 or 2,000, maybe 5,000 acres. Well, Roosevelt kept expanding it to Mount Olympus at 650,000 acres or the Grand Canyon at a number similar to that. And then mainly what I really am focused on in this book is how then Roosevelt's legacy is another 100,000 or more. It's growing all the time, national wildlife refuges. Mm-hmm. So you get that figure of 234 by what he actually saved through forest, and then also this this legacy of creating the National Wildlife Refuges, which is the core of U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
And he did this mostly by just declaring it to be so.
He did it with his national monuments that way, and he did it with the wildlife refuges. Yeah. He bypassed national parks, had to go through Congress. So, for example, 1908, the thought was it went through Congress, the Grand Canyon, and it was voted to mine it for zinc, copper, and asbestos. Roosevelt thought it should remain its beauty unmarred, that the Grand Canyon was our Louvre and Westminster Abbey and Taj Mahal combined. And so he just used his power, almost a war power, to declare it a national monument, put it in that holding pattern. After he left the White House, it became upgraded to national park status.
Yeah, hard to imagine if the Grand Canyon had been mined and we had lost that great treasure. Let's talk to Mary. She's calling us from Montana. Mary, where in Montana are you calling us?
I am from Gallatin Gateway, Montana.
And where is Gallatin Gateway?
Well, I'm about 70 miles north of the west entrance to Yellowstone. So Yellowstone is practically in my backyard.
All right. Well, you're a lucky person. Did you have a question or a comment?
I do have a question. First of all, I'd just like to say God bless Teddy Roosevelt, because I think, you know, Yellowstone is a treasure. And when I visit it two or three times a year, and the tourists that are there are primarily foreign, it's amazing. You see Japanese, you see Chinese, you see Germans and French people, and they're all fascinated with it because there's nothing like it in their countries whatsoever. But my question is, what has the reintroduction, or rather the introduction of the wolf back into Yellowstone, how is that tipped the scales, or how is that, has it been a success or has it been a failure? Because we see a lot less elk in the park now than we used to, say, 10 or 15 years ago.
Secretary Salazar, tell us a little bit about this issue.
You know, the wolf is one of the species that we do protect under the Endangered Species Act. We have a recovery program underway, and we have healthy populations of wolves in Yellowstone and in the surrounding areas, and also up in the Great Lakes area. So the wolf is very much a part of our wildlife legacy, and it's one of those animals we want to make sure continues to have a healthy population in our country. I would say that one of the great things that Yellowstone, I think, typifies based on your comment, is that Yellowstone is a real economic engine. When we think about the 400 million plus visitors that we get to our national parks every year, all over this country, you have people coming from outside of the U.S. into this country. You have people from the United States traveling to places like Yellowstone or Yosemite or the Grand Canyon or Acadia in Maine or the Everglades, wherever they go. They are part of the tourism economy. They are creating jobs. And as they create jobs, those are jobs that can now be exported. And that's all the more reason why, in a time of crisis that we are in today, economically and internationally, that it's important to make the kinds of investments in places like Yellowstone.
And how has the reintroduction of the wolf gone, do you think? Has that been a success?
It has been a success. The wolf is not now an extinct population. It would have been if United States and working with our partners at the state level had not stepped in. But we have recovery efforts that, in fact, have been working, and we're proud of those efforts in the Idaho, Montana, and in the Great Lakes area.
All right, Mary, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Susan. She's calling us from Chesapeake, Virginia. Susan, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to address this to Secretary Salazar. As a child, I wrote President Kennedy begging him to protect the wild Mustang. And I'd like to know what's being done for the wild Mustang. There are several sanctuaries, the Black Hills Wild Horse Sanctuary, run by Dayton Hyde, very great man, and the Wild Horse Institute, who it's being run by Madeline Pickens. And what is the possibility of the BLM, United States, getting behind saving these national treasures? We wouldn't be here today without the horse. They helped settle this country, and they need to be protected.
All right, Susan, thanks for your call.
Susan, I appreciate the question. First, I love horses. Grew up side by side with a horse for much of my life, and very much love them, too. We need to understand that we have a management issue with wild horses and burros on our public lands. We have 19,000 more than the carrying capacity. And so what we need to do is to come up with a program that may include additional lands and forage areas for wild horses and burros. And we're working on that. And I believe that we'll have an effective plan in place here very soon.
You know, I'm sorry, Douglas Bunkey, did you have something you wanted to add?
Well, no. I mean, there's one possibility, and I think the caller's touching on it, which is worth the Obama administration looking at, in my opinion, is can you create new reserves for types of animals? Can you create national Mustang reserve somewhere? Can you do a national polar bear reserve? Can we have a national caribou reserve? TR set that precedent by doing that with buffalo, elk, antelope. And it's worth looking at how that can be done, and it might mean additional lands. It might mean a redesignating of some lands, for example, up in Anwar in Alaska. I mean, there's a potential to do a national caribou reserve in the Anwar lands right now. So those are some of the exciting things about the new administration being placed, because they're looking at all of this.
Well, what would be the hurdles to establishing a reserve like a caribou reserve or using part of Anwar, which has been a place of great controversy in terms of whether to allow more energy development there? What would be the hurdles to doing that now?
Well, I'm a historian, and I try to stay judicial and stay on my focus of 100 years ago. But I would be remiss if I said I would like to see Anwar become a national park someday. I think many people would like to see it preserved as the world shrinks all the time and we have a problem with overpopulation. We're dealing with issues of climate. The thought of being able to save a pristine patch of wild Alaska permanently appeals to me. So if you asked me if I had a magic wand, I would like to see it declared a national monument or a national park But the laws are it has to go through Congress because of the way that was it's not a typical presidential ISO declare it. You could do that, but then it would still eventually have to make its way through Congress, and you'd have to find the votes. But I'm hoping in the next years that might happen.
Well, Secretary Salazar, when you think about the Obama administration and your own tenure at the Interior Department, what kind of legacy do you hope to leave here? And what kind of legacy does President Obama hope to leave here when it comes to this particular set of issues?
You know, I think there are three on this particular set of issues. I think when the world judges us 4 years or 8 years from now that we will want to have acted in a way that saves our planet through energy and climate change legislation that addresses the dangers of global warming and pollution, that creates jobs here in America, and that reduces our dependence on foreign oil. Secondly, that we take a conservation moonshot much the same way that TR did in 100 years ago. And thirdly, that we connect up our young people to the outdoors and to the landscape. So it's about energy and climate change, treasured landscapes, and young people.
And what's a conservation moonshot? What does that mean?
It would mean doing some of those kinds of things that Doug Brinkley was talking about. You know, some of them are more complicated than others, and we have to do that, which we can do. But we are certainly in the process of looking at places all around the United States of America relative to what we want to protect in a way that 100 years from now, people will look back at this time and said, you know, they did the right thing. So that's what we're doing.
You know, we're in the middle of this terrible recession, which has hit a lot of Americans. We've got this big debate going on about health care reform. Is it hard to get attention to the issues of conservation and national parks and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't think it, frankly, is a mutually exclusive kind of thing. You know, there obviously is a lot of attention on health care. I'm involved in helping the president on that agenda. We need to do it for America. It is critical to our health and to our well-being economically. But we also, at the same time, need to keep our eye on other things, and that includes our treasured landscapes.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Doug Brinkley.
Well, you know, we're talking about landscape and Theodore Roosevelt's legacy. If I could, I just want to read you something that TR wrote, just to give you an idea of what a fierce advocate he was of America parklands in the wild. Here's Theodore Roosevelt. "We regard Attic temples and Roman triumphal arches and Gothic cathedrals as a priceless value. But we are, as a whole, still in that low state of civilization where we do not understand that it is also vandalism, wantonly, to destroy or to permit the destruction of what is beautiful in nature, whether it be a cliff, a forest, or a species of mammal or bird. Here in the United States, we turn our rivers and streams into sewers and dumping grounds. We pollute the air. We destroy forests and exterminate fish, birds, and mammals, not to speak of vulgarizing charming landscapes with hideous advertisements." This is 100 years ago. You could see how fierce he was, and he was president of the United States. So he didn't just inject the word conservation into our national parlance. It was almost like a Niagara Falls approach to making this happen. Each park, bird reserve he created, there was blowback from local people. But in the long run now, history says Roosevelt was right to save these places. And I think that will be seen 100 years from now. If the Obama administration takes that proactive stance, history will reward them for that.
Now the quote you read sounds quite modern. Well, Secretary Salazar, you talked about what you want your legacy, the Obama legacy, to be. Talk for a moment about the legacy of the previous president, of President Bush. You have been pretty critical of the Bush administration when it comes to its handling of the Interior Department.
I have been, Susan, and frankly, I think that the prior administration disregarded the law and disregarded the science on many issues, from the Grand Canyon to leasing oil and for oil and gas near Arches National Canyon and other places in Utah, and a whole host of other examples. But having said that, you know, we've turned the clock on those decisions and are looking proactively. And it's most important that we look ahead and not look back. And as we look ahead, you know, some of the inspiration from Doug Brinkley and Ken Burns and others who are so wedded to this possibility of our landscapes and what we can do in this 21st century is something that is very critical, and it's integrally tied to one of the signature issues of our time, energy and climate change, which is something that we're working on very, very hard. And so I think that we will do some great things in the years ahead. I think we will restore some of our national significant landscapes from the Everglades to the Chesapeake to the Bay Delta. I think we will find opportunities in Alaska and Maine and a whole host of other places where we can actually do some great things to protect the landscapes of America for future generations. And I think this is an exciting time, very exciting time.
One of the first things you did was to cancel 77 oil and gas leases in Utah. Why did you do that?
Yeah, the essence of it was that they were too close to some of our national icons. Arches National Canyon National Park is one of the most beautiful, awe-inspiring places in the world. I don't want to see oil and gas drilling rigs that you can essentially see from within the arch. And so we are taking a look at where it's appropriate to drill. You know, I don't believe that we ought to be drilling everywhere. The president doesn't think that we ought to be opening every single place up for oil and gas or other kind of development. There will be oil and gas development, but it doesn't mean that we have to turn over every rock to take out every last drop of oil.
We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about whether the effects of climate change already are being seen in our national parks, and we'll take more of your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org, by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The relationship between a passionate reader and a beloved writer. A young college student falls in love with Albert Camus and his work. She describes a 40-year affair of the heart and mind with the Nobel Prize-winning author. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We're talking with the Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, and with Douglas Brinkley, the historian, about the national parks, Teddy Roosevelt's legacy, and their future. Secretary Salazar, I'm wondering, have you seen the effects of climate change in the national park system?
We have, Susan, and we are very cognizant of the fact that we have got to adapt to the reality of climate change. Climate change is here. It is beyond debate now. Scientists agree that it's here. If you were to take almost any state in the country, and essentially if you were on a computer with a computer-generated map and you'd click onto the state and you'd move it 300 miles south, that's essentially what we would see relative to the changing precipitation patterns. So you take New Mexico, you take it 300 miles south and you're in the deserts of Chihuahua and Mexico. Dramatic kinds of impacts it's going to have on all of the geography. but in particular, from my point of view, also the geography that we have to protect with our parks and our wildlife refuges. And so climate change adaptation is very much a part of what we're working on in the department.
Now, I know that there's a big cap and trade bill that's being debated in the Senate, but I'm wondering, are there things that the national parks themselves can do to try to address the issue of climate change?
We already are doing it. We are studying the effects of climate change and getting ourselves ready to take whatever measures we have to take to protect these assets from the reality of climate change, the rising sea levels, the changing precipitation patterns, the impact that it's going to have on wildlife and on vegetation resources. So we have within the department, as a result of an executive order that I issued, a renewable energy and climate change task force that is looking at all these issues. So we're on it. We're working on it hard, and we're working also very hard to pass the energy and climate change legislation.
Mm-hmm. Doug Brinkley.
Well, Theodore Roosevelt never really liked automobiles, and he thought that it would kind of, because they made so much noise, and birders don't like the rumble of cars in general. So one of the things national parks, I think, can do is start, you know, many of them are now, but using alternative fuel in their tour vehicles. So maybe you park at the entrance, but then you have a golf cart-like or a natural gas being used in buses in the park or maybe solar panels on the lodges in the parks to start. And also, to add to what Secretary Salazar said about climate, I mean, we need to establish new national wildlife corridors due to climate changes and other things.
And what is a national wildlife corridor?
Well, I'll pick one, but there are many. Like the U.S.-Mexican border, you know, we have the jaguar in the United States, beautiful giant cats, as pretty as any you would see in the Amazon or in Africa. And they're few and far between, but they come around Douglas, Arizona, and we're building a wall with Mexico down there, and it's cutting off wildlife corridors because animal species don't know borders, you know, and by blocking and creating this wall, it's doing great damage in Arizona to a host of wildlife, with the jaguar simply being the most symbolic. I could pick other places where that's happening. So I think while we're dealing with how to grapple with the monster of the climate problem by the scruff of its neck, we probably need to start thinking how animals are going to be changing their migratory routes due to it, and how we can learn to accommodate them.
We have an email from Emily. She's writing us from Durham, North Carolina. She writes, I would like to know what the Secretary has planned for the Park Service's historic resources, the millions of important artifacts, art, and architecture. They have suffered from years of deferred maintenance, poor preservation, and overutilization. Will there be more of a sustained effort and capital investment at protecting, conserving, and preserving them?
The answer to that is yes. We are working hard on the historic preservation part of what we do in the department. We recognize that telling America's story is part of America's great outdoors and America's history, and that's the battlefields of the East, or whether it's the history of the Southwest or the history of Native Americans. It's all part of our mission within the Department of Interior. I think it is a co-equal mission with the protection and preservation of our natural landscapes. And so we have an eye on it, and we will be working very hard to implement an effective agenda.
All right, let's go to Rick. He's calling us from Florida Keys in Florida. Rick, hi. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, great. Thank you for taking the call. I think it's very interesting we're talking about TR. I'm a big fan. And, you know, I think first and foremost, he was an outdoorsman. And I'd just kind of like to hear some comments on, you know, he also founded the Forest Service and had this huge conservation agenda, which also calls for using natural resources, timber and mining and whatnot for future use. And I'd kind of like to see what the Interior's Secretary's comments are on going one step further than national parks, which are a wonderful way to preserve lands, but possibly what the administration has in mind for future wilderness areas, which are the highest level of protection for animals and for nature. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Rick.
We want to work very hard on making sure that we are identifying wilderness areas that need protection, and we are in the process of doing that and looking at other landscapes as well. You know, I was having a conversation with Doug Brinkley today, as well as a few days ago, about how the times now are different in 2009 than they were 100 years ago when Teddy Roosevelt left office. And we have a different reality. You know, for TR, in many ways, you know, he could go out into the western part of the country and he could say, I so declare. or he could go to other places, as he did in Pelican Island, and he can say, "I so declare." We now have a different reality because of our population growth since then, and the fact that many of the best of the public lands have been set aside. But that doesn't mean that there aren't huge challenges and opportunities for us. I see us working at the national landscape level to try to identify those areas that we can truly restore and protect, as well as those places which have not received consideration recently. Doug and I have talked about many of those, and hopefully we'll be able to be very proactive on this agenda so that at the end of 4 or 8 years, there will be a very significant conservation legacy that mirrors the values of TR.
Just to add, our caller's from Key West, and Key West is one of the places Theodore Roosevelt saved as a federal bird reserve. Also, it was then Tortugas Keys, which is now Dry Tortugas National Park. And in fact, if you look at Florida, all those wildlife refuges, Mosquito Inlet, Pelican Island, Indian Key, Passage Key, Palmasola, On Island Bay, these were all federal bird reserves. Roosevelt believed that America had to save its bird populations because we had extinctions going on. There used to be 1 billion passenger pigeons. There's not one left. The Carolina parakeet had gone extinct. The flamingo, which we think of with Florida, is no longer a native species in Florida. It got shot away. And he was very worried that people were just slaughtering these birds. So he put very strict laws to protect the birds of Florida. So anybody who enjoys that wild native alluring charm of Florida and what all those beautiful birds down there mean, we have Roosevelt and a group of ornithologists like Frank Chapman to thank for it.
You know, we talk about Theodore Roosevelt as a great conservationist, but he was also quite an avid hunter. Is there any conflict, do you think, between his activities as a hunter and his appreciation for wildlife?
Well, remember, when TR was hunting, that was a different America. We were a rural America. Hunting, everybody hunted. What Roosevelt did was start enforcing laws, law enforcement on hunting, seasonal hunting, bag limits, animals that were, thin. One of the callers were talking about wolves. TR used to shoot wolves, and he was very worried about them attacking the elk population of and the cougar he was worried about in Yellowstone. But later in his life, he said, let's keep it. We've got a good balance. Let's keep the cougar. Let's keep the wolves. Even though he was hunting them as being nuisances, he had evolved environmentally to thinking that these animals, which he wrote about so brilliantly, both wolves and cougars were two of his creatures that he wrote about very well. But Roosevelt would only shoot what he would eat. He was a big game hunter, a trophy hunter, and he created the Boone and Crockett Club, which was aristocratic hunters wanting to save animals. And if there are any hunters listening out there, many of our best conservationists are hunters, and we need to just establish that there doesn't need to be a split between the environmental movement in that regard. Roosevelt also had to collect in those days. It was before radar and bird banding en masse or something. So to study after Darwin, to study, say, a bluebird, you needed for the Smithsonian or American Museum of Natural History, you needed, 10, 20, 30 samplings to get to differentiate between the birds so you can get a kind of fuller understanding of what we now would call their DNA makeup.
We have an email from Dennis, and he writes, how do the rangers who work and manage the national parks feel about the new law that allows concealed weapons in the parks? As an avid user of the parks, particularly Big Bend, I'm very uneasy about this. Secretary Salazar, what are the rules and laws now that govern people bringing guns into national parks?
Well, I would expect that most of the rangers in national parks are concerned about it. We are implementing over the next 9 months the new law that was passed by Congress with respect to concealed weapons. Congress passed a law that essentially says that we need to have uniformity and recognition of concealed weapons laws across the country, and looking at state law to give us direction. It creates complications for us at the National Park Service. And so we are doing an in-depth analysis of how exactly we can implement it in a way that honors two principal values here. First, it's the protection of the public, and secondly, the protection of our officers who are also exposed to dangers. We had an officer that was killed on the border of Arizona just a few years ago. And so we recognize the dangers here. We're trying to develop a program that is workable within the dictates that have been given to us by Congress.
What does the new law require that you do?
The new law requires us to be in compliance with the state-initiated laws on concealed weapons. And because each of the 50 states has a different kind of law, it's an enormous undertaking for us to do the analysis and figure out what kind of rules are going to make sense for us that will give the legal guidance to our parks rangers.
Barbara sent us an email that said, I would like to hear how the plans for supporting expansion of wind energy and solar collection and energy transmission while preserving natural lands and wildlife corridors. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely, Barbara and Susan. I think that part of our future here in this country will be how we harness the power of the wind, the power of the sun, the power of geothermal, and we are well on the way to doing that. I've spent a lot of my time working on those issues over the last 6 months, and we will get it done. But it doesn't mean that we're going to be developing everywhere. We are going to have the right kind of approach where we decide where it is that it's appropriate for development of these renewable energy resources and where it's not. And where it's not appropriate, it will be because of wildlife or other ecological sensitivities.
Doug Brinkley.
Well, yes, and if I could, because I know we're running a little bit out of time, but when I just wanted to mention, while I was working on this book, I had an assistant named Stone Weeks, and his father has worked for National Public Radio for a long time, and Stone was coming up from my book launch with his brother, and they were killed on a Virginia highway in a horrible traffic accident. And I write a paragraph in this book about what a great young man Stone was, and I just wanted to honor him by mentioning him here, because when I have to go on book tour this week, losing this friend and compadre and somebody who helped me with research and was so excited about the park, somebody who did not have nature deficiency, both Stone and his brother Holt have a memorial service for them next week. But as I go on book tour here, their spirits with me.
And what did Stone Weeks do for you in the process of putting together this book?
Well, I had hired Stone out of University of Delaware, and he was and he became my research assistant at Rice University, and he was an internet wizard, which I'm not. So he could find things of on obscure parks and forests and species, and I had to educate myself about ornithology, for example, and so we were on a journey together. I would go around writing the book and visit these places. If I was writing about Wind Cave, South Dakota, I'd go. If I was writing about Crater Lake, Oregon, I'd go, and he would hold the fort back home at Rice University, and he was the best. I've had other assistants, but I never had one that got so into this. In fact, he wanted to go into a career in forestry, and he was studying his GREs this summer, looking at schools ranging from the Gifford Pinchot program at Yale to a program in Oregon to actually go into a career in forestry. So it's just while I'm excited in that he got to see the early good reviews of the book and saw the book, it's sad for me to be going forward now without him.
We're so sorry to hear about their death, and we certainly offer our sympathies to their families, to their family. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You know, you've got an opportunity, Secretary Salazar, with this documentary that Ken Burns is coming out with this fall that focuses on the national parks. Do you plan to try to use that as an effort to generate interest in the parks?
We will, and I think there are two great opportunities. One is Doug Brinkley's book on the Wilderness Warrior and TR, and the other is the Ken Burns documentary on our national parks. I think with respect to our national parks and our landscapes, as I look ahead and the instruction that I gather as I read Doug's book and as I've met with Ken Burns and seen parts of the television documentary, is that we now need to look at America's next best idea. And America's next best idea is about all the landscapes of America, including our wildlife refuges and places that we haven't even thought about. And we're in the process of putting those lists together right now.
And Doug Brinkley, have you worked with Ken Burns on this documentary? And what should we expect from it?
It's a tremendous documentary. Ken kindly wrote a dust jacket blurb for my book, which is very important. I feel a little bit like a John the Baptist figure for Ken's big production coming out. It's spectacularly done. I think it's going to rivet the country, and it's going to start a dialogue. And it's not what's exciting in the environmental movement, a wilderness movement in the country beyond the Burns documentary, which is going to be amazing, is Secretary Salazar himself. As you seeing Susan here today, we have a really first-tier Secretary of Interior who's willing to talk about issues that people feel very frustrated and bottled up about and find a way to start a kind of new conservation movement, as he's putting it. And that's exciting for anybody out there listening that's involved with land issues or wildlife protection issues.
Secretary Salazar, I know that you and Barack Obama arrived at the U.S. Senate at the same time. He was 99th in seniority and you were 100th. You lived in the same place at one point. How do you think, as someone who's known him in that time, how do you think he's handling all the pressures and frustrations of the White House?
You know, I think he is doing wonderfully. There is no doubt that when President Obama came into office, that he inherited the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. We have two wars that he's been having to handle, and the reputation that the United States had around the world that he needed to stand up the country again. So in all that context, he is doing very well, a lot of work ahead, but we're excited.
Secretary Salazar and Douglas Brinkley, the author of a new book called The Wilderness Warrior, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.